So again, good evening and welcome again. And it's a real privilege to be here with you this evening. I'd like to begin with a little bit of a story that maybe is a metaphor for the talk this evening. I was in New York last week visiting my daughter and her husband and my three grandkids, 8, 6, and 2. And I went to, took a couple of hours off from my duties and went to this local Starbucks and sat out in the patio and did some emailing and things that I needed to do. And what was different from this day from some other days that was that there were visitors came along. They were known here as Yellow Jackets. In other English-speaking countries, known as WASPs, not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, but the buzzing ones. And I was there for a couple of hours. And it was very, very interesting just watching people's responses to the situation. It wasn't like there was a whole swarm of them. There were maybe half a dozen over a period of, you know, the time I was there. But I noticed really two different reactions. You know, most people went in one or the other direction. The first was people who, you know, see them coming, the yellow jacket coming along and maybe kind of do a little, kind of brush it away like that. And, you know, if it gets too close, you might do a little bit of this. But overall had a kind of live and let live attitude to the yellow jackets when they came along. And I noticed, you know, those folks were, you know, carried on with their work and did their calls and, you know, did their emails and whatever they had to do. And I noticed there was another response from a kind of a number of people. And this was much more on the level. Kind of swat them, get them out of the way. What are they doing here? And one thing that I noticed was the more agitated they got, the more agitated the yellow jackets got. And in just about every situation where folks were in a kind of a didn't like this and wanted it to be different, they ended up actually leaving, either going inside or leaving within a couple of minutes. And I thought, this is interesting, really. Now, I acknowledge that for some people it may be really harmful to get stung, and you know, there's very good reason for them to avoid being in a situation where they could be stung. But it just seemed like, you know, most of those situations, I would guess, weren't those. But they were just kind of the mind, you know, I don't like this. Maybe some of us have that kind of attitude about, you know, different flying creatures. But it spoke to me a lot about kind of how our attitude can affect our experience. There was no way that folks who wanted things to be different in this situation, wanted these animals to be, these flying animals to be gone, that they could be okay with, you know, with just kind of them coming and going as they did. And so I thought of this because I was thinking about this talk at the time and I said, oh, that's interesting, you know, because the theme of the talk, and it's not in any way meant as a judgment, because there is no judgment there at all, but just kind of like the way we react to different things and the consequences of that and what comes out of that. So the title of the theme of the talk tonight is Dancing with Life in Difficult Times. Now, I borrow the metaphor dancing with life from a friend and meditation teacher, Philip Moffett, who's part of the Spirit Rock meditation community on the West Coast. It's a wonderful book on the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha's Four Noble Truths, Dancing with Life, Buddhist Insights for Finding Meaning and Joy in the Face of Suffering. So, but I feel the metaphor is a really helpful one. And just to borrow something else, I borrowed the metaphor. And another teacher has a very nice kind of aphorism that all wisdom is plagiarism. All wisdom is plagiarism. Only ignorance is original. So if you say something that seems wise, somebody said it before, you know. We borrowed it from somebody else. And I borrow that from Gil Fronsdale, and who knows, he may have borrowed it from somebody else. But so this image of dancing with life, and really what it speaks to is that the core of the Buddha's teachings is that true happiness, peace, and freedom come from our relationship to our experience, not by getting things, getting more stuff, getting rid of the things that we don't like, or having an ideal situation. You know, it comes from within, from how we meet the present moment. And when we meet the present moment with acceptance and with kindness, with an open heart, the kind of qualities that I was inviting and encouraging in the meditation, we can find freedom in the midst of even the most difficult circumstances, amidst life's 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows, in the language of Taoism, the Taoist teachings. And the converse of this is when we meet our experience, when we meet this moment with resistance, we suffer. In Buddhism, there are seem to be three refuges. They're sometimes called the refuges or the jewels. They are some things that we can go to that are reliable. You know, ultimately, we can't rely on our possessions or our job or anything that we want to hold on to. Ultimately, is unreliable. Everything is going to come and go. Everything is impermanent. But the Buddha taught that there's three things are reliable. One is, and we talk about these as taking refuge in these three jewels or these three refuges. The first is the Buddha. And the Buddha, in this sense, it means not just the historical Buddha who shared these teachings that have come down to us, but on another level, the quality of awakening within each one of us. You could think of it as what Quakers call that of God, that kind of light within us that knows that, you know, what the truth is, ultimately knows where our true freedom lies. Not that we can always access it, and perhaps people may go through their whole life without seeing that possibility, but it's really an inherent possibility in all of us that we can truly wake up, you know, that we can truly experience freedom in this very life. This is the first of the refuges. And I'll jump to the third of the refuges, and that's taking refuge in the Sangha. And we could call this the Sangha, the community of those who are committed to waking up, committed to living freely, compassionately, wisely. But even more, the community of all beings, because no one is separate. You know, it's a community. You could think of it as taking refuge in love, in connection, in our interdependence. So I jumped to the third of the refuges to come back to the second, which is really what I'm going to be talking mainly about today. And this is known as taking refuge in the Dharma. And Dharma really means truth. And what it means is, you could talk about it as the Buddha's Dharma, the Buddha's teachings about suffering and the end of suffering, and the way we reach the end of suffering. We can see it, the Dharma, in that sense. But even on a deeper level, I think we can see it as taking refuge in the truth, taking refuge in reality, taking refuge in the way things are. You know, and this is important. We don't have to like the way things are, but it's taking refuge, finding the truth in this is how things are right now. Tara Brach uses the phrase in her first book, radical acceptance, really deep-rooted acceptance of the truth of this is where things are right now. This is where my life is. This is where I am in this moment. So, you know, it may not be what we thought of when we were, you know, 18, like my life is going to be like this. It may be the circumstances may be really dire. You know, we might hit rock bottom. And then we would still be in this place of saying, can I take refuge in the truth that this is where I am right now? And it's only from there, from taking refuge in the truth, in reality and acknowledging that this is how things are right now, that we can really move towards freedom in our lives. One teacher uses the very simple phrase, it's like this. It's like this. Whatever it is you're experiencing, it's like this. You know, just kind of if you just do a little turn inward to your own experience right now, your own emotions and thoughts, sensations. You know, what is it right now? What is it you're experiencing? You say, it's like this. You know, I'm feeling restless or I'm a bit tired. Why did I come here tonight? You know, you could think, okay, it's like this. It's like this. I'm not suggesting you leave. but you know, if this is what's here, this is what's here. You know, we can ask the same about, we can say the same about our world. You know, I'm sure many of you have thought over recent months, maybe recent years, you know, couldn't the world, couldn't our political system be different? Couldn't it be better than it is? Couldn't it be more heartful than it is? Why can't the killing in Syria and so many other places end and on our own streets? Why is it so hard for us to respond to the challenges of a changing climate, of a changing planet? You know, we might have all of these things that, like, why isn't it different? And if we get caught up in this, like, this should be different, without acknowledging that this is what is right now, this is the truth, then we're going to inevitably suffer. It's not in any way to say, and I'll be talking about this this evening, that we don't do anything, that we don't work to change things. But we have to start from where we are. I found myself in recent months sometimes waking up in the night. Anyone wake up in the night and, you know, and kind of, you know, the words of Wendell Berry's poem, The Peace of Wild Things, he said, when despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night, at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be. Maybe some of you have had some of those thoughts in recent times, maybe waking in the night or at other times, and what the outcome of the election will be and what the costs will be. And I find when I try to solve these problems, when I try to think my way through to the answers, you know, as the mind often tries to do, you know, going to work this out. What could we do? What can I do? What, you know, if I'm in that place of tightness, I get more tight and I get more tense and I get more kind of locked into things, more anxious, more stressed out, and I suffer. It's only by opening my heart to my own pain and the pain of the world, to the grief and the anger, to the sadness, to the fear, that I find my way to peace amidst the joys and the sorrows. But it's really a journey, and I feel I've been on this journey a lot in these recent times, perhaps more than at other times, and maybe you have as well. The Buddha said, don't cling to anything as I or mine. Whenever we cling, we suffer. And when we let go of clinging, suffering ends. It's as simple as that. When we're caught up in clinging, there's suffering. There's a sense of things aren't the way we want them to be. They should be different. I don't like the way things are. But if we can find a way to radically accept this moment as it is, be with things as they are, here and now, then we find that becomes the doorway, the pathway to freedom of the heart. The Buddha taught that mindfulness, this practice of being with our experience just as it is the pathway to liberation. It's called it the direct path to liberation. Whatever, we can bring mindfulness to any aspect of our experience, and that can then be the doorway to freedom, because we can see where we're holding and we can see how we can let go. And then that gives us insight into the larger truths of life. You know, the truth of impermanence, the truth that nothing can be held on to, the truth that, you know, there isn't a permanent self in all of this, that the self is the clinging itself. We see these larger, deeper truths, and there's great freedom that comes with those insights. So this image, this metaphor of dancing with life. It's to open fluidly to the challenges and the difficulties, to the joys and the disappointments. It's not passivity or resignation. Sometimes that's what, you know, this practice is thought about. It's not, oh, just whatever, you know. And it's really the opposite of whatever, you know, or whatever, which is that kind of resignation. It's really an engagement. It's an aliveness. It's to be fully engaged with life. It's to love life, but in a way that we're not holding and controlling, but it's a dance with life. And to truly love life, we have to accept it as it is, don't we? Otherwise, it's an ideal, or it's an image, or it's a memory. We can only love the truth, you know, the truth of how things are. I can't love you and say, I love you, but you should be different, you know? I mean, sometimes we might think that, you know, I could. Or I love you, but I want you to be different, you know? If I love you, then I love you as you are, as you're manifesting with all of your weirdness and all of, you know, all of the idiosyncrasies and all of that. Now, there's other very helpful language and metaphors for dancing with life as well. You know, I said radical acceptance. Saying yes to what is. You know, again, just kind of check in with yourself right now and see, can I say yes to what is? Can I say yes to what is here right now? Can I say yes to this moment in my life, this time in my life? Or is there some sense that in order to be okay, things need to be different than they are? And if that's what the mind is saying, that's not a problem, but it's an invitation to say, can I say yes to this too? Can I say yes to the resistance? Can I say yes to the wanting things to be different than they are? And just acknowledge that that's the truth of what's here right now, and meet that too with kindness. I use Rumi's metaphor of welcoming the guests in the meditation. You know, he says, welcome the guests, even if they're a crowd of sorrows. He says, the dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So again, that image of the guests, you know, the guest house. We're here and we're welcoming these guests that are coming to visit. For me, that's always been a very long, long time. That's been a very, very helpful image, you know. The guests, they come, they don't stay forever. And the more, like with the yellow jackets, the more we want to get rid of them, the more they party and, you know, ruin the house. So the invitation is, can we welcome the guests? Can we say yes to them and then let them do their dance? And not to say, oh, I want you, but I want to get rid of you. But kind of meet them with an equal heart, with equanimity. There's another lovely expression I like, kind of a little bit Zen-like, from the Jesuit writer and philosopher and teacher Anthony de Mello, who called defined freedom as absolute cooperation with the inevitable. Absolute cooperation with the inevitable. You know, what is here right now is inevitable. And not meaning by that that it had to be in some predetermined sense. You know, it's here because of causes and conditions led to this moment, to you being here in the way that you are here now, to me being here as I am right now. It's inevitable in the sense, you know, in the sense of inevitable, it is unavoidable. It is the truth of this moment. So can I cooperate with the unavoidable truth of this moment? And with that, there may be things to change, but I do it from this place of acceptance that this is, you know, this moment is inevitable. Can I dance with this moment with life? So they all of these images, and in a sense, all of the teachings are a kind of pointing, you know, aren't they? They're kind of pointing things out. In Zen, they don't like to use too many words because words get in the way. They're concepts and they're dualistic. If it's this, it's not that, isn't it? But in Zen, it's like pointing, you know, sometimes hitting somebody with a stick, I mean, with kindness and compassion. But, they, you know, in Zen they have the stick, the kiyosaku stick, you know, that kind of like, kind of to wake you up. The stick to wake you up, not to hurt you and harm you. You know, you actually invite, I think in most traditions, you tap your shoulders and you invite the stick to give you more energy on retreat, you know. So the stick. The pointing in Zen, kind of like, it's here. And one teacher, the Korean Zen teacher, you say, what is this? What is this? And, you know, this could be anything. You know, it's just the reminder to come back to this moment, to this inevitable moment, this unavoidable moment. So I want to contrast dancing with life with another image that might be meaningful to you. And this is where there isn't so much fluidity. And I think of it as wrestling with life. Wrestling with life. Maybe we could write a book, Wrestling with Life. Because I think that's what we do a lot of the time, is to wrestle with life. We try and control life. We try and make it the way we want it to be, force it to be the way we want it to be, and we suffer. And I distinguish this from kind of a wise intention to, you know, get the job that you'd like or be in a relationship you'd like and, you know, save for retirement. All of these things have a sense of desire in them, but without the clinging. We're not, you know, if we're doing it in a way where we're really holding on tight and clinging, that's where the suffering is. That's where the wrestling with life is. And the Buddha taught that there were three main ways that we wrestle with life and suffer. The first is when we reach out and we go out to get what we want. And again, I distinguish, as Philip Moffat does in his book, between wholesome desire, you know, I want, you know, I'd like this. I'd like this to happen. I'd like a certain result on November 8th, you know. And if I can hold that in a kind of spacious way, and then that's fine, no problem. But if I get into this place, it's got to be like, what's going to happen, you know, in this place, then I'm going to suffer, you know. So there's a real difference between, you know, desire, wholesome desire or skillful desire, and unwholesome desire. And the Buddha's pointing to wanting or striving or craving as the unwholesome desire. It could be for possessions. It could be clinging to our views and opinions. What an idea. Anyone ever cling to their views and opinions?
I'm right. They're wrong.
You know, and when we don't get what we want, or somebody disagrees with our views and opinions, God forbid, then we suffer. At an extreme level, this can become addiction or obsession, where everything fades away except the object. Got to get it. And then, of course, when we do get the thing that we want, it only satisfies us for a short time, because the problem wasn't the thing, it was the wanting, wasn't it? I mean, the problem lies in the wanting, in that wanting energy, in that unskillful energy. So we don't have to change. It's not about changing the thing, you know, the drug or the drink or the shopping or whatever it is. It's about being with that energy without having it needing to lead to this particular outcome. So that's the first, this wanting, the clinging, where we wrestle with life. The second way we wrestle with life is through aversion. It's kind of the opposite. If this is a pulling towards the first, the second is the pushing away. And again, certain forms of resisting things. If something, you know, is coming towards you to do harm, yes, you want to push it out of the way or jump out of the way. But this is where aversion is a form of clinging. We want something to be different, and we're not going to be okay unless it's different. This person needs to change. That person at work that keeps doing this thing that I don't like, they have to change. Or this political situation has to change for me to be okay. You know, when we're caught up in that aversion, again, it's distinguished from being like, yes, I think we should change this law, or, you know, I think if this person might work with some of their communication skills, that could be a very wise thing to do. And if I can help them with kindness to do that, That's one thing. But where we get into this solid, separate self and the bad other, that's where there's suffering. And that's we wrestle with life when we get caught up in aversion. And we can do it. We see it how we can do it when we don't deal skillfully with our emotions, with anger or fear, how rather than feel the fear, we can put it out on other people, you know, in order to not feel what we're feeling. And that sense of aversion can lead, as we know, to violence and to conflict and to hatred and to division, where it kind of congeals, where that wanting things to be other than they are congeals into a kind of solid self and other, us and them. We've got to destroy them in order for us to be okay, all of that. And that's a painful form of wrestling with life, of not dancing with life. The third way the Buddha taught that we resist life is through, he called it broadly, delusion. Greed is the first, hatred or aversion is the second, and the third is delusion, where we check out of life, that we separate ourselves, we avoid our experience. We might see what's happening as boring, and we look for something that's more interesting. We're not present with what is, and we can check out. We find this a lot in our current present culture, to modern culture, where you might have seen there's a wonderful Louis C.K. clip of him on Conan O'Brien saying, you know, how we don't want to be with our experience, even for that little moment. We don't want to be with that horrible feeling at the pit of our stomach. So we go and people going on their cell phone and risking their lives and other people's lives because we don't want to be with that inner pain and difficulty. So we see this when we check out from our experience. You know, you might see it in your own life sometimes where you're feeling maybe anxious or sad or confused, but it feels like, I don't want to be with this. It doesn't feel nice to feel this. So when we might eat something, or we might go online, or we might, you know, see who's responded to our Facebook message, or, you know, how many likes we've got, and, you know, all of these things. Not that anyone would do that. But have a beer. Really, when we do that to avoid feeling what we're feeling, then we suffer. We suffer in terms of separation. And I have a fourth, you know, to add to these, which is kind of included in different ways, but is so much part of our modern culture, a way we wrestle with life and suffer. And that's through incessant doing. When we get caught up in constant busyness, activity, with the belief that if we don't keep doing things, things are going to fall apart and everything's going to be terrible. And this doing, this busyness, can be a source of much of our stress and our anxiety. And with each of these unwise ways of responding to the present moment, to our experience, we're avoiding the present moment. We're avoiding or resisting what is. And it's painful. We suffer. We feel tight, contracted, we're not at ease, we're not in a flowing relationship to life. We can often see this from how we're feeling in our body. Is there tightness in the belly, in the chest? Are we kind of closed up? And the invitation is just to see that, just to be aware of that, and to breathe into it, and just come back and say, can I be with this moment as it is? Can I open to life as it is here and now? If I think about this political season that we're in right now, I see the seeds of all of these unskillful responses in me. I see myself getting caught up at times in wanting a particular outcome. And if I'm not mindful around that, I can suffer. I remember 8 years ago, I was on a retreat with a Tibetan teacher here or in this area, and Sokni Rinpoche, just before the elections. And I was on a silent meditation retreat, but I was still looking at my cell phone at Real Clear Politics. Had the polls changed? You know, There's nothing wrong with looking at the poles, but look at our relationship to that. You know, am I clinging here? Am I in that wanting things to be a certain way? I see anger and fear and judgment arising, aversion, in response to some of the words and actions that I see that are harmful. I see myself getting caught, moving into those more aversive states. And again, it's not to say that we aren't judicious and clear about what we see as harmful in the world. Absolutely, we should be. But we can also get into a relation, you know, a conflictual relationship. They should be different. That's terrible. How could they say that? I also experience a wish at times to check out and just shut down. Has anyone been there? Just like, oh, wake me up in, well, who knows when it... 40 years. And I also see I can get caught up in stress and worry if I paint pictures about how things will be if something happens on November 8th. So this is a really a field of attention, of awareness. You know, I think many of us are caught up, and it's not a problem that these energies are present, but it is really a question of how am I meeting this moment? How am I meeting my fears when they come up? How am I meeting my clinging to things being a certain way? How am I meeting my checking out, wanting to check out from the experience? How am I meeting being stressed out by all, you know, by reading 100 articles in a day, you know, thinking if I get a little bit more information, I'll have a better understanding of it. And then feeling kind of overwhelmed by things, you know. It's just like TMI, too much information. So the remedy in each case, and that I forget at times, but that through this practice I can keep remembering, is to open fully to all that's arising in the body and the heart and the mind. To say yes to this fear, feel how it moves through me. This anger, feel it. This sense of hope, feel that too. See the stories and let go of the stories. Feel the sadness. Just really open to it without the story. Just how does that feel in the heart? How does it feel in the face? It's not to stop caring, but it's to let go of clinging. Again, T.S. Eliot said, teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still. A sense of caring, of, as I see it, of really caring, of really being concerned, of having our hearts open, of loving life, loving the world, but not caring in a sense of, you know, of clinging and holding on. Can we find this balance where we're really engaged, but we're also, we're bringing awareness and wisdom and compassion into our engagement in the world? I want to, you know, take a little pause and then come back to the second part of the talk. And I want to reflect on something that's going on. I want to share something from a friend for a few moments and have a short meditation, and then come back to the second part of this talk. And that is, we open to life and we dance with life. But then what happens? What do we do? Where do we go from there? You know, how do we engage with the suffering of the world? And that's really what I want to talk about in the second part. And I want to just take a pause to reflect on, I know many, I am, and many of us here experience pain with what's happening around the killings in many, many areas of the country by police. And I'm bringing this up not in order to in any way take sides or judge or get into blaming or shaming, but to explore this from a more a heart place than a judgment place. And I want to share, and I asked this a friend, Aisha Ali, to if it would be okay to share this, what something she wrote about her experience. She's a member of our community, the Insight Meditation community here. She wrote this in August. And it'll who she is and where she's coming from, but will become clear from the what she shared. It's called Walking the Eightfold Path with No Shoes on My Feet, the Buddhist journey of a working class African-American woman. And she says, being present, numbness versus strength. My son has recently had a gun held to his head and was robbed of a small amount of money this past Wednesday. This was in August. I was within a nanosecond of being another black mother torn asunder by the death of her black son. This tragic figure that is so common in our media that it is viewed and barely remarked upon. This is what happens to us, we black people. We get killed in everyday existence, and some even see this as our lives. The violence erupting because of fatal flaws and decisions. I've always understood that my child, my black son, is at constant risk. My stomach tightens every time he leaves me. At 19, he doesn't even have the patina of childhood to protect him, although some studies show that black children are seen as adults as young as 10 years old. This recent occurrence changes my black and white fear to technicolor. Not beaten and left concussed as he was a year and 4 months ago, but dead this time, a violent anniversary. I am numb. I talked to police, I went to work, and I cancelled the phone and made arrangements through the insurance company to get him a new phone. I am numb, not strong. I cannot fully deal with the idea of burying another child. The thought occurs that I have often mistaken numbness for strength. The crash that awaited came as a surprise. It devastated me in part because I was unaware of its roots. I am numb, but because of the practice, I am aware of it and not lost in the only positive fantasy this society allots to black women. We are so strong in the face of real nightmares. Many of us carry outrageous burdens of awareness every damn day. Many of us are numb. The gift of the practice is awareness. I am numb but aware of it. I am numb, so I am walking and feeling my body as it moves and awaiting the inevitable crash that will come with curiosity and hope. The crash will not surprise me, and the hurricane of fear, despair, resentment, anger, and tears will find me ready. Namo Amida Butsu. I take refuge in the Buddha. So I'd like to just invite us to sit for a few minutes and take some time to just settle into a posture. This will be 5 minutes or so. But I invite you to relax and settle and open with kindness to what's alive for you right now, to your experience just as it is, here and now. If it's helpful to take a breath or two, you might do that, a deeper breath. Just open to whatever is present in the body and the heart, the mind and the spirit right now. And I invite you to just reflect for a moment on something that's difficult or painful that you're dealing with right now. There might be some left over from sharing that story, or it might be something in your personal life or work or the overall political or social situation. How are you feeling it in your body? Whatever comes up. Maybe nothing comes up, and that's fine. Just sit with whatever is present. But if there is something that's difficult or challenging, you might just see how are you feeling it in your body. Is there tightness somewhere, or contraction? Maybe a feeling of tenderness. In your emotions, is there sadness Maybe anger. Is there joy? Maybe there's peace or calm. Just open to whatever is present. And notice your thoughts. Are they busy and active, thinking about a lot of things, or moving into the future or the past, or more at ease, more settled? Just notice there what's present too. See if you can breathe in and make space for everything. See if you can invite an attitude of dancing with whatever you're feeling. Letting the feelings, the sensations, the emotions, the thoughts come and go. How is it to meet what you're feeling with friendliness, with acceptance? How is it to dance with your life as it's unfolding right now? How is it to take and meet this changing flow of experience here and now, and meet it, dancing with your experience, dancing with life, breathing into it, giving space for it? Maybe it's not so easy to do that right now. How is it then to just even envision the possibility of dancing with something that might be quite difficult and painful? How is it to breathe into and open to this more flowing relationship with your life as it is, as it's unfolding, as you're experiencing it? And include too all of the life around us, this current time in history that we're living. How is it to breathe into this and dance with this too? You know, with a don't know mind, with a mind of not knowing how things are going to unfold in the coming weeks and months and years, but letting your heart be as open as it can be to life. To life as it is right now. Dancing with life. You might take a breath or two. Poet and writer David White says, enough. These few words are enough. If not this these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here, this opening to the life we have refused again and again until now. Until now. So in these final minutes, I want to kind of bring it towards how we live in the world, how we live this truth, this openness in our life. Often people think that the Buddha's teachings are very good at cultivating strength and inner fortitude to open to difficult experiences, you know, to have the ability to be with what is. And a lot of people think, well, this is probably a good way of being in the world, that if you're open-hearted and meet your experience as it is, you're probably going to be able to engage with life in a more flowing and a more happy and peaceful way. But there's also a view that the teachings stop there, that it's all about the inner life. It's all about just, can I be at peace, and not about the suffering of the world. And that's often, I think that's a kind of a misunderstanding that's very much out there, that these teachings and practices are about transforming our inner life and have little to say or to contribute to how we address the larger suffering of the world, of poverty and injustice, of war, of racism, of climate change, of all of the things that we're facing. And one thing that's true to say is that these teachings and practices don't prescribe a particular form of action. They don't say, you must be an activist. you must be out on the streets, you must be out getting arrested, you know. Or you must be a nun or a monk, you know. They don't prescribe that. Each one of us must decide our own role and our own path. But the teachings and the practices have much to say and to offer to help alleviate the larger suffering of the world. And I want to share an old Zen story some of you may be familiar with, but it's a powerful one for me. It's very simple. It's a student coming to visit his dying teacher, a Zen student, and asking him, what is the fruit of a lifetime's teaching? What is the fruit of a lifetime's teaching? And the old teacher replies, an appropriate response. An appropriate response. The fruit of a lifetime's teachings are an appropriate response. And that's really what these Dancing with Life helps us find an appropriate response. My response may not be the same as your response. My response today may be different from tomorrow or yesterday because the conditions are different, because things change, life changes. Appropriate is appropriate to the situation, to the conditions, to the context, to everything. So looking for an appropriate response. So the training of the heart and the mind, the Buddha's teachings on suffering and the end of suffering, the path of training in wisdom and in mindfulness and in ethics provides the support for us to meet our experience and our life open-heartedly, to dance with life, and then to respond to the cries of the world. When we awaken to who we truly are, we see that the separation between ourselves and others and between ourselves and the world is only one of form and appearance. It's not the deepest truth of life. The deepest truth is we're truly interconnected. And this sense of separation is really a product of not seeing things as they really are. It's a product of clinging. You could say it's a product of mistaken identity. We see these people, them out there, as different or as threatening. And out of that often happens out of our fear and out of our separation, out of our defensiveness, that we don't want to open to and feel our own pain. So we can easily kind of put it out on others. There's a wonderful statement from James Baldwin who said, I imagine that one of the reasons that people cling to their hate so stubbornly is that they sense once hate is gone, that they will be forced to deal with their pain. We cling to our hates as a way of avoiding feeling our pain, as a way of avoiding dancing with life. A couple of other quotes that I think may be helpful. The Tibetan teacher, you know, capturing this sense of the separation being in form rather than in truth. Kalu Rinpoche, he said, we live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. We are that reality. When you understand this, you see that you are nothing. And being nothing, you are everything. That's all. Maybe they just sit with that one. You know, there is a reality. We are that reality. When you see that, you realize you're nothing. And being nothing, you're everything. Maybe a slightly simpler way of putting it is from Sri Nisargadatta. He says, wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between these two banks, my life flows. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between these two banks, my life flows. When we dance with life, meeting the joys and sorrows with an open heart, there's a natural arising of compassion in the face of suffering. We see and we wish that we respond to alleviate the suffering. There's a natural arising of compassion and the desire to alleviate suffering. You know, we see this in the Dalai Lama and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese teacher. this, that the more the heart opens, the more compassion arises, the more the separation between self and other breaks down, falls away. And through practice and training the heart, we also see that the suffering of the world is actually a collective expression of those three unskillful ways of being with life. These three, you know, what the Buddha called the greed, the hatred, and the delusion. The suffering, the wars, and the conflict are only those same three qualities, those three same unwholesome or unskillful ways of dealing with the world writ large. You know, it's not that they're anything different. They're, you know, we see the wars and I've got to kill you before you kill me. And it's that same separation that comes within each human heart. And it's the separation that we get together in our groups and we see, oh, us, we've got to defend ourselves. We see, the genocide in Rwanda, you know, Hutus killing Tutsis and sympathized, you know, anyone that they saw as a threat, you know, out of an ideology and this sense of fear that got writ large and then could then be directed against, you know, those who are seen to be the threat to them. You know, we see it's the same, it's fear, it's greed, hatred, and delusion writ large on a social level. And we see this, and the more we see it, we see the possibility of that falling away. And we can also see, the more our hearts open, that the world needs these practices of awareness. I don't mean that in any sectarian way, that the world needs Buddhism. You know, I don't think the world needs Buddhism. The world needs Buddhas. You know, the world needs more human beings that are awake, whose hearts are open, who can open and dance with life and not turn fear and anger into conflict and hatred and demonizing. We see that the world needs these practices of awareness. It's really important that we change laws and structures and institutions. That's really necessary. But if these changes are not accompanied by changes in the human heart, changes in the way we relate to each other, practices of awareness, of conscious awareness, of mindfulness, of compassion, of seeing ourselves in others and others in ourselves, of equanimity, the capacity to respond to pain without recycling it, without pushing it back out on the world. Without that, any change will just keep repeating the old cycle. As the great Zen teachers, the Who, said, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Remember that one? Unless we work on the inner and the outer at the same time, nothing's going to change. It's going to be the same cycle. Imagine a politics where town councils, legislatures, the White House, Congress grounded their work in conscious awareness, in cultivating compassion, in deep listening, in reflection on the consequences of the actions they're going to take, in wise and conscious communication. It is happening. It's happening bit by bit. But imagine our politics being imbued with this kind of consciousness. I think it's the only, my own view is it's the only salvation for the world. And I use this in a broad sense of consciousness, not as Buddhism, because there's many traditions that carry the same wisdom in them. But it's about meeting each other with an open heart. I think this is what this moment is calling for. And the teachings and the practices give us the courage to open to the truth of life as it is, to respond to suffering with compassion, to meet difficulties with equanimity, and to stay engaged, to stay engaged. It's a lovely statement attributed to Anais Nin. She says, and the day came when the risk that it took to remain tight in a bud was more painful than the risk that it took to blossom. Is that kind of, we live our lives on this edge, really, of closing in fear and opening in love. And it's not to say that it's a bad thing when we close in fear. We need that quality. We need it at times. But we don't need that to rule our life. That's when we suffer. When we get caught up in fear, in that we solidify it, we harden it, we separate to self and others, we get into conflict and division, and we feel we need to destroy others. Martin Luther King, Dr. King, said, "I've seen too much hate to want to hate. And every time I see it, I say to myself, hate is too great a burden to bear." And he goes on to talk about how we'll meet your willingness to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure suffering. And he said, and this is the beauty of this, what he said, we will not only, and he's talking about white racists in the segregated South of the 60s. He said, we will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will appeal to your heart and conscience so that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. So that it's no one gets left out. Our hearts remain open to everybody. Nobody is demonized. So this is the practice, this is the training that of dancing with life, of letting our hearts be open. So just to take 30 seconds to finish off this evening, if you can, and just notice what's present for you. Maybe taking a breath, appreciating your practice today and the presence of everyone else here. The great poet Rilke said, "I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not complete this last one, but I give myself to it." So thank you for your time and your kind attention this evening.